Yeah, well, thanks very much, and it's great to be here celebrating Bill's birthday. It's probably going to be a little bit different, this talk, from a lot of the other ones that I've heard so far. So let me explain. So what I'm going to do in this talk is say a little bit at the beginning about heteroclitic networks. I'll come back to that in a minute. Then I'm going to, the particular problem I really want to talk about is connection selection, which I'll explain what that is. Not going to be able to say very much about it, and the remainder of the talk will be about product dynamics. I'll say more about the results later. It's not really possible to say much at this stage. Let me say a little bit about heteroclinic networks, though. There's been a lot today about homoclinic connections and so on. There's various ways of approaching this topic. I mean, why would one want to look at these things? One way is obvious. I mean, one of the original motivations was to model kind of transient dynamics. Another, obviously, from today and yesterday's talks, is the idea of transport, that you can use homoclinic connections to kind of move yourself around the solar system in an efficient kind of way, using very little energy. My own personal approach to this is that often when one looks at heteroclinic networks, one perhaps should think of them as kind of templates for complex dynamics, in the same way that the equilibrium before the Hopf bifurcation contains within it the rotation that you see after the bifurcation. Many heteroclinic networks also possess, in a sense, the germ of kind of rather singular and complex behavior. And even though these things sometimes come out of symmetry, sometimes out of other problems, often this complex behavior persists if you break the symmetry, and I'll say a little more about that in a while. So I'll start with a kind of archetypal network, I guess, that everyone knows here. That's the Guckenheimer-Holmes one. I'm going to do this on the two-sphere. You'll see a lot of spheres at the beginning of this talk. So just to remind you that you have a bunch of equilibria on the sphere and one-dimensional connections between equilibria. This isn't really so interesting from the point of view of complex dynamics. This is two-dimensional. Obviously, these are fundamental domains for the group action there, just of the diagonal matrices. So you can just take an orbit quotient and look at the triangle there and analyze that. And the most you kind of expect to see here is perhaps periodic orbits. That's in the two-dimensional case. So in simple situations, heteroclinic networks will typically be comprised of a number of nodes, which for the moment I want to think of as hyperbolic equilibria with index 1. That just means a one-dimensional unstable manifold, together with one-dimensional connections between nodes. So I've just drawn an example here of a one-dimensional connection, which is usually the unstable manifold. We'll look at somewhat more general things in a minute. But it's interesting that even in the case of one-dimensional connections, the dynamics can be extremely complicated near heteroclinic networks, at least near attracting ones. So I'd like to mention one or two works here. For example, there's a recent thesis of Manuel Aguiar-Porto, who shows that in a particular class of heteroclinic networks, which is actually associated to a low-dimensional polynomial ODE, you can actually get random switching between the nodes of this network, and this switching, is the modeling is precise. I would say in this talk I'm very interested in precise analytic results. There's nothing really qualitative in what I'm saying here. So in this particular instance, the switching is precisely quantified by a subshift of finite type. Actually, it's a full shift on 20 symbols, so it really is kind of tossing a coin. Fair coin with 20 sides. Tells you how you switch around the network. So this switching is actually modeled by a hyperbolic subshift of finite type, so it for sure persists when you break the symmetry, and it occurs arbitrarily close to the network. And I should point out other people's work that relate to these kind of problems. There's certainly Vivian Kirk, Mary Silber, and of course John Guckenheimer and Patrick Wolfock, and I'll come to that example in just a second. So let's start with a very simple example of this, again, one-dimensional connections. So this, if you remember in the picture I showed a moment ago of the original Guckenheimer-Holmes network, we had a triangulation of the sphere And these spherical triangles here were invariant, the boundaries were invariant by the flow, so you can't escape from those triangles. So if we go to one dimension up, we are looking at a three-sphere, and so now we take an orthant in the three-sphere, which I've drawn here just as a tetrahedron. Of course, it's a spherical tetrahedron. And for appropriate equivariant dynamics, you can, in fact, make the edges of this simplex here invariant by the flow, but the faces need not be invariant. So what can happen in this kind of problem is that you can have trajectories which maybe spiral around the edges here. Maybe it stays inside the tetrahedron, but eventually escapes, and then maybe at the next node it switches into another tetrahedron. So this kind of model, it's a low-dimensional ordinary differential equation that comes from equivariant dynamics, provides a suggestive kind of model for switching around the nodes of a network. And indeed, results were obtained on that by John Guggenheimer and Patrick Warfoot. I'll come to the explicit reference in a minute. So I just want to show an indication here of what can happen when you look at some other models. This relates a little bit to the work of Manuela that I mentioned. So in this case here, what we've got is two invariant circles which have four equilibria on them. They're index two equilibria here, so it's two-dimensional unstable manifold with complex eigenvalues and a one-dimensional stable manifold coming in. The circles are actually invariant. There'd be some symmetry forcing this. This is a kind of somewhat reduced from the actual problem. So if you look at one of the unstable points here where you have an index two equilibrium, you have a two-dimensional unstable manifold. And what you can expect in this problem, this is all on a three-dimensional sphere, I should say, is that the two-dimensional unstable manifold will meet the two-dimensional stable manifold coming in at another point. Okay, so you expect a transverse intersection, and that means, in fact, a one-dimensional connection there. So how does this affect the dynamics? In the actual model I'm thinking of, which is a polynomial ODE, which induces a flow on a three-sphere, just a cubic differential equation, and you actually have five of these invariant circles. I didn't want to draw the whole picture here. So what actually happens is you can imagine you use Shulnikov-type analysis here. I call this kind of phenomenon a Shulnikov network. You kind of go out along here, spiraling around that, go along here, and then there's a kind of switching that can occur when you shoot around here again, which can mean you either come out on this side or that side. And it's this sort of example that enables you to model the switching around a network by a subshift of finite type, which is hyperbolic. So what I've discussed so far is just one-dimensional connections here. So let me remark on kind of generalizations here. The nodes can certainly be limit cycles or chaotic sets, and that's the idea of cycling chaos, which has been looked at by various people, including, I guess, people here. And this is a more interest to me, the next comment. You can also have continua of connections between nodes. So this kind of behavior where you don't just have a one-dimensional connection but maybe a two-dimensional connection or more is typical of the kind of networks that can be expected in coupled cell systems, which Marty talked about yesterday. But that's another talk. I don't want to get into that here. Yes. And of course, when the group is not finite, that's certainly so. So in this case, by the way, in the invariant subspaces that come up in the problem, which is forcing these cycles, typically correspond to synchronous states. So now what I'm going to say is, in a way, going to get a lot simpler, and this talk is really very simple in terms of what I'm talking about. I want to focus on the study of dynamics and asymptotics near a heteroclinic attractor. And the main thing I want to consider is that of connection selection. So what's connection selection? Let me try and describe this by one example, which is a kind of artificial example, but it's quite an interesting example if I change a couple of things inside it. So this again is an example on the three-sphere, and we think of the three-sphere as the union of two solid balls. Here's one of them, and the other one's outside, of course. So the dynamics here will be as follows. We have a two-dimensional sphere which is invariant by the flow, And we have a nice hemiclinic connection, which in fact is the whole of the two-sphere, going from the unstable manifold of A to the stable manifold of B. And we have a one-dimensional connection going around, joining B up to A either way. Okay? And to give some dynamics on this, we can in fact do this with a couple of repelling periodic orbits, one outside the two-sphere and one inside. And it's easy to complete this to a vector field on the three-sphere with nothing else happening. So in this case, I want the equilibria up here to be have real eigenvalues. As I say, it's a little more interesting when they have complex eigenvalues, and real eigenvalues which are different in size. This is the expanding part. I've drawn the local picture there. So the final comment that I want to make is I want these periodic orbits inside and outside the sphere to be repellers. So the two-sphere, together with this one-dimensional connection, will form a heteroclinic attractor. Okay. So what's going to happen? Well, if I can get the arrows right here, if we start off here, we're going to maybe wind around this orbit here, and then we come in there. The question is, what direction are we going to go off in as we pass this point? See, there's a strong direction here and there's a weak direction. So we're going to come in, and you'd expect that maybe you go along the strong direction, which is maybe this direction here, and maybe, of course, it doesn't have to be strong there, and then you go around again, and you kind of always go in or out along the strong direction, or does it randomly occur? So basic question I want to ask here is, supposing we're looking at a point in the basin of attraction of this hemiclinic attractor, then what generically is the omega limit set of that point? So more precisely, what are the connections in the two-sphere contained in this hemiclinic attractor that you expect to actually see in the dynamics? Do you get all connections, or some more often than others? This is the kind of issue I want to talk about. So let me just give a little history here. This, I gathered originally that these talks would be online, so this particular talk I put references in. Some of them are clickable as well, so you can go to websites. But let me just say the issue of connection selection, as far as I'm aware, was first raised in a paper of Peter Ashwin and Pascal Chaussard a few years ago. And of course, there's lots of other references. I'd mentioned the work by Kirk and Silber, and also some work I've done with Peter Ashwin on heteroclinic networks, and also Ashwin, Rutledge, and Sturman. And of course, the Guggenheimer and Wolfert paper that I mentioned before for that three-dimensional simplex. So I can get to the next page. So what I have to do now before describing the results is to tell you a little bit about the terminology. Most of this, I think, will be familiar to everyone here, but I have to confess all of it wasn't completely familiar to me when I started on this. And the definitions are very important here. So we're looking to start with at a continuous flow or semi-flow defined on some compact region, M, in Euclidean N space. I'll assume that M is forward invariant under the flow. Take Lebesgue measure on Rn. If we take a subset of M, we let Bx, as usual, be the basin of attraction. So that's, everyone knows that. Then we say that a compact invariant set is a Milner attractor if the measure of the basin of attraction is strictly positive. And if we choose any proper compact invariant subset of X, then we don't kind of take up the whole of the basin with that. So what's left will have strictly positive measure, if I said that the right way around. So we say it's minimal. So this, for example, would work perfectly well if you had a couple of attracting fixed points. That would certainly be a Milner attractor. You pull one of them out and, you know, it will satisfy these conditions. But it's obviously not kind of minimal. So I'll give a definition of minimal here. The idea is an attractor is minimal if for all proper compact invariant subsets of the set, the measure of the basin of attraction is zero. And the thing to remember here is this characterization of minimality. All this goes back to Milner's original paper on this. It's minimal if and only if you can find a full measure subset of the basin such that the omega limit point set of points in this set B is X for all X in B. So minimal, what you're seeing is exactly what you see. The minimal attractor is what you see typically. All points will be asymptotic to x if it's minimal. And you fill up the whole thing. One final definition here, which I'll come back to in a little while, is that of the likely limit set. So we suppose we've got an invariant measurable set with non-zero measure, then the likely limit set is the smallest closed invariant set that contains all the omega limit sets except for a zero measure subset of the set we started with. So it's kind of the smallest kind of limit set which captures everything. So if you've got a Milner attractor, it's easy to see the likely limit set at a basin is x. So these are the definitions we need. And now I want to talk about a homoclinic attractor. So I'm going to take a nice model homoclinic attractor in the plane. This is the picture you should remember. The attractor is just the boundary. We have a one-sided neighborhood H here, which will be contracted onto sigma. The eigenvalues will be minus A and B, where A and B are positive. So now I need to say a little bit more about this. It's pretty general, this attractor, but I have to be careful. So I'm going to make some assumptions. I'm going to assume that the flow we're dealing with here is at least C7. In fact, C6 with Lipschitz derivative is okay, with the attracting homoclinic cycle. So I said this before, the eigenvalues are minus A and B, and then I assume some non-resonance conditions here. That's integer multiples of B up to 4 are not equal to A, and 2A is not 3B. And under these conditions, the flow is actually C3 linearizable at the origin, and this is a theorem of Salaval originally, about 1972, and Belitsky also, you can find it in 73. I won't need these hypotheses for all the results I give you. So again, we have the forward invariant one-sided neighborhood. We restrict to the flow to H, or now it's a semi-flow, and it's well known and kind of elementary that that sigma is a minimal attractor, and of course the likely limit set of H is sigma. All well known. So results. It doesn't look very good, and in fact, when I started this project with Peter Ashwin 3 or 4 years ago, I was kind of very discouraged at the beginning that we were actually going to be able to prove anything at all. But, you know, sometimes it's a good idea to leave things and you kind of work on them a bit and then suddenly it kind of gets rather nice. That's maybe one of the advantages of getting a bit older, that you can kind of choose your problems a bit more. And I have to say that the results, even though, to kind of paraphrase Hardy, I suspect they have no applicability, I rather like the results I'm going to give you now. They give me a lot of pleasure kind of doing the proofs of these. They're all rather different, actually. So the first result is this one. It says, supposing we've got a periodic flow, I've made it linear periodic, but that's kind of irrelevant, on the circle, or a hyperbolic attracting limit cycle, then you look at the product dynamical system, and then it turns out that the limit cycle across the circle is a minimal attractor for the product system. That's the product system's on the product of the homoclinic times the circle. So what this means is that for almost all initial conditions, what you see in the limit set is the whole of the product. This uses those strong hypotheses on the flow, and I'll have more to say about that. Second result, which is quite different, which doesn't use as much on the flow, supposing we take your favorite chaotic set, so I'll take a suspension of a subshift of finite type, or a basic set if you want, or a hyperbolic attractor for flow, then when you look at the product here, sigma cross x, it's a Milner attractor for the product system. So this is, as I'll come back to in a little while, relevant to things like cycling chaos. It says you don't miss much. And the final result says, well, this actually is the one that relates to what the original topic of what Peter Ashwin and myself were doing in the connection selection issue. Supposing we take a couple of homoclinic attractors and look at their product. Now here, they're very simple here. We have an equilibrium on the cycle, QI. We look at the union of the two cycles, that's Q1, the equilibrium of the first cross the second, plus the first cycle cross the equilibrium in the second. Then the result is either sigma or the product sigma 1 cross sigma 2 is a Milner attractor. I think maximal is not really relevant here for the product system. So this says there's very strong connection selection. You only see typically one of two orbits. The or is a little bit embarrassing, right? So I won't say anything in the talk, but it can be shown that, at least if you make stronger assumptions, that you in fact just get this situation here, in a very strong sense. So let me say a little bit about the proof of the first one, because I think this is the most interesting one. So we look at the circle, and just regard it as 0, 1, with 1 and 0 identified. And as I kind of indicated, the minimality of this follows from the fact, this theorem here, that for almost all initial conditions, Z in the Hamiltonic attractor, theta in S1, the omega limit set is the whole thing. So proof of the theorem, sketch. So take a cross-section for the flow on the Hamiltonic attractor and look at the product of the section across the circle. This is the circle here, for the product flow. And we define a return map in the usual way. So here's the picture. The idea is this is to be thought of as a circle here. So we start off at some point, zoom around and come back, and we define in the obvious way a sequence of iterates, Zn, theta n, lying in this product, T, which is section across the circle. So we have to prove that for almost all Z theta in T, theta n is, well, what I'm going to prove is uniformly distributed in S1. That would certainly do it. Slight overkill, notice the word I'm putting in there, uniform. So it's good to kind of do a quick bit of revision here. When you look at these kind of problems of product dynamical systems, the simplest one is looking at the product of two limit cycles, where it's well known if the periods are irrationally related or not rationally related, you get quasi-periodic, you know, dense flow. What you actually need for that is really the fact that if you look at an irrational number and look at the fractional parts n alpha, then that's uniformly distributed in 0, 1, if alpha is irrational. Obviously, that's not going to be much use here. For Hamiltonic cycles, the return times grow geometrically, approximately as a constant times lambda to the n, where lambda is actually the ratio of the eigenvalues. Actually, remember, A is positive, the way I chose it. So we might expect to use Weyl's theorem here, that when you look at this sequence, C lambda to the n, this is uniformly distributed in 0, 1 for almost all choices of C. C is going to correspond to the initial condition. But obviously, this is far too precise an assumption to make on a Hamiltonic attractor. They don't come back as C lambda to the n. There's a lot of other stuff in there. Right? So let me describe the proof. The proof is a large wastepaper basket sort of proof. In other words, actually, it's the sort of thing I don't think I'd have attempted before tech, because I'm just too lazy to write it all out. But being able to copy and paste all the things in this makes a lot of difference. even so, I still filled up a lot of waste paper baskets on this one. So let Sn be the return time for the nth hit, right? That's the time it takes to go around n times. Then after some work, and there is a little serious work here, it can be shown that for all n greater than m, this difference here, that's I'm taking the derivative in z of the time for the nth return, take away the derivative in z with respect to the nth one, is monotonic. That's either increasing or decreasing, but not both. And when I look at the differences of the derivatives here on the time map, that's uniformly bounded above zero. So that's the technical part that requires a little work. It'd be appreciated for anyone who's ever worked on this. Then you can use a theorem of Davenport, Erdos, and Levick, but under those conditions, this sequence here, theta, which is what we're interested in, plus omega tilde snz, is uniformly distributed in 0, 1. Almost all z, but not all, by the way. It's just almost all. So let me give the relevant theorem here that I'm using. I'm saying, given a sequence of functions on alpha beta, such that we have this monotonicity condition and this bounded below condition here, then under those circumstances, this is uniformly distributed mod 1. Okay, you can find a proof, for example, in Glenn Harmon's book. This is quite a tricky theorem. This is kind of non-trivial, the number theory part here. Let me say, from the point of view of the analysis, the hard thing is to prove this part rather than the monotonicity. In fact, when I first wrote it down, I forgot to do the monotonicity, but it's kind of easy. It does require working out the second derivative, however, of the return map. So let me say a few words about a product with a chaotic set, and be very few words here. this is really statistics, and this isn't a meeting about statistics. So what it amounts to showing then is the likely limit set of H by the suspension is this product. To do this, you need a fairly detailed knowledge of subshifts of finite type, and you need to use the Borel-Cantelli lemma. This is kind of strong law of large numbers stuff. I won't say any more about it. It's not clear to me at this particular moment whether you have a minimal attractor or not here. When I originally wrote the notes, I said it was unlikely it was a minimal attractor, and now I'm weakening that to not clear. So this is kind of relevant for cycling chaos. It means that if you have chaotic nodes, that what you would expect as you go around, that you're filling everything up. You're filling all the trajectories up. So it's not kind of picking out just one or two trajectories. Though, it's, as I say, it's not minimal quite. Product of homoclinic attractors. This, again, is a little different. Just to recall, what I'm looking at is the two branches here. This is the theorem that either sigma, that's this sub-network here, or the product is a Milner attractor. So I'm actually going to do a tiny proof here. It's a tautological lemma. So here's the lemma for like about likely limit set. So suppose you've got a forward invariant set with a positive measure, then X lies in the likely limit set if for all epsilon, and this is a nice bit, for all full measure subsets H of Z, you can find one point in there such that the omega limit set meets the disk center X radius epsilon. So the strength here is for all full measure sets. This looks a lot weaker on the face of it than the original definition. And the way you do this is you say, well, if X doesn't belong, then that means very easily from the definition there exists an epsilon and there exists an H of full measure such that this is so, and then you take the negation of that statement and there you are. As I say, it's tautological. Okay, so this leads to a rather neat little result which gives the results I was just talking about, and that is if you look at a couple of, say, C1 flows here on compact regions, then the likely limit set is actually invariant under the R2 action defined by the flows, so you don't have to have the same times. I won't give the proof here because it's getting to the end of my time, but what I will do is I'll flip forward. And it follows from this result that it's the result I want, the likely limit set is either this or that. The reason is that now you can, if you suppose you have a point which lies in the product, which doesn't lie in sigma, then you can iterate it by one of the times, keeping the other one fixed, and then the other time, and you fill out the whole thing. That's easy. So the expectation is that you always have this result here, and that this is always a minimal attractor. But we've only been able to prove this under rather strong assumptions on the return maps, and even then the methods are tricky. You have to work with restricted Diophantine conditions and Liouville type estimates, so kind of Liouville numbers come into this, to quantify the bad initial conditions. Roughly speaking, the point is you have to look at double sequences like this and kind of find the limit points. I'm almost finished. Okay, so let me just end with a couple of questions or generalizations. I think the first one is kind of interesting, actually. So, in the product of a homoclinic by a limit cycle, I got everything, but it was under rather strong assumptions on the flow, namely C7 and linearizable at least to C3. So the question is, to what extent do we need those assumptions? So, for example, if the vector field is only C1, is it true? Well, I conjecture it isn't true, and I conjecture that, in fact, you can expect to see things that are locally like Cantor sets cross intervals in that case. So a little bit like the Denoir example. That's kind of a rash conjecture, but let me make it. If it fails to be C2, if it fails to be, say, C3, or maybe fails to be C2 linearizable, but there's plenty of smoothness, then my guess is that you probably lose the uniform quality of the distribution, but it's probably still true. But C1, only C1, I'm sure it fails. Obvious question, can you generalize all this to general heteroclinic attractors? Obvious question, can you generalize all this to skew products, weak coupling? And some of the answers here are yes, and some I'm not sure. Okay, well, thank you very much for your attention.